We have the soul accepting into itself all of the allurements of the senses and becoming drowned or intoxicated by them. In this case, we are dealing again with a psychological problem of the individual who attempts to drown the purposes of his psychic life by means of ignoring the better part of his own nature and the principles for which he stands. Ulysses has great difficulty in rescuing his companions from this condition, but he is able himself to escape and to continue his long voyage home. And in the course of this voyage, he comes to many interesting things. His ship has to pass between a great rock and a whirlpool. And this rock is, of course, and the whirlpool represents desire and anger. The desire meaning attachments to the past, attachments to a state inferior to himself, or unreasonable ambitions concerning his own future condition. These desires are also balanced by anger. And in the achievement of psychic polarity, the individual must guide the ship of his soul between the extremes of desire and anger, or the extremes of mortal love and hate. Without overcoming these extremes, he is unable to preserve his course. So each of the journeying adventures of Ulysses have to do with the gradual regeneration of his powers and his motion little by little away from darkness and ignorance and toward the achievement of his heroic destiny, the destiny for which he had dedicated himself. The most dramatic and pictorial, and probably the outstanding episode in the entire story, is the adventure of Ulysses with Circe the Enchantress. Circe the Enchantress is a delightful problem and is right in line with our most immediate problems and the destiny of man today, because now sense, or the sense powers, have come head-on into imagination, represented by the sorceress. And imagination is not, of course, a being outside of man, but an excess within himself. Imagination is man's instinctive tendency, when working with the early structure of the psychic life, to exchange excess as an escape mechanism physically with imagination as an escape mechanism emotionally or psychically. By imagination, of course, Circe is able to transform all of the attendants of Ulysses into beasts. And Ulysses himself has a very difficult and terrible time to escape from the snares which Circe builds. And the Neoplatonists point out this very important thing, that until the soul is stabilized, imagination cannot be directed or controlled. And therefore, that imagination, uncontrolled, is responsible for the larger part of errors which exist in man's world of affairs. Imagination causes the individual to deceive himself. In the level of sense, he is deceived by others, perhaps. On the level of imagination, he deceives himself. For he takes a world and transforms it according to the hazy and uncertain impulses of his own desires. Imagination enables him to see anything the way he wants it to be, regardless of whether it is that way or not. Imagination causes him to fill his world with false doctrines and beliefs, to pursue will-o'-the-wisps, to mistake passing pleasures for immortal verities, and mistake always the pleasant for the truthful. It permits him to wander about in long, circuitous passages without being able to rescue himself. And once he is captured in the snare of imagination, it is very difficult for him to restore his philosophical equilibrium. The French transcendentalist Eliphas Levy, in one of his works, refers to this sphere of imagination as the astral light. And he says it is a beautiful garden around the stem of each flower, a deadly serpent twined. This is the magic garden of Klingsor in Parsifal. This is the mysterious world of things that are not so. And those worlds in which nothing is good or bad, but thinking and feeling make it so. This is the world in which gave us the Inquisition. It is the world that gives us tyranny, gives us cruelty, gives us heartlessness, gives us hate and fear and terror. This is a world of ignorance, superstition and fear, ruled over by a strange, intangible goddess of excesses. This is Circe the Enchantress, which is nothing more or less than man's undirected use of the imaginative power of his own soul. This imaginative power is under the ancient guardianship of the lunar principle. Therefore, it ebbs and flows, waxes and wanes, like the moon. It passes into eclipse and casts a strange, mysterious light upon the world. It transforms the objective realities of day into the strange, subtle, intangible, often confusing shadows of night. It rules with a strange silver light over all things. Circe the Enchantress is therefore that part of man's own nature which is forever crying for the fulfillment of desire against the demands of character. And in this case, of course, there is a greater illusion added, for man can convince himself that what he wants is good for him. He can also convince himself of many errors about himself. He can be very foolish and convince himself that he is learned. He can be very selfish and convince himself that he is kind. He can be filled with hate and convince himself that it is love. All of these illusions arise from his inability to estimate the basic values of his own existence. Now also, in the fable, Circe takes on the appearance and similitude of another character. This particular circumstance causes the illusion or the delusion of Circe, or of Ulysses towards Circe, who feels at some times that she takes on the appearance of his true wife, Penelope. Thus imagination comes to him in the form of truth and takes on the likenesses of realities. Later, when we study Penelope a little, I think we'll be able to see why Circe takes this form. But we are dealing definitely with a whole world of pseudo-psychic phenomena, of pseudo-psychological phenomena, the basis of nearly all neuroses, frustrations, and phobias. For all these things arise from some kind of ignorance. And mostly they arise from man's unwillingness to face facts naturally and reasonably, and his inevitable instinct to clothe them, dramatize them, color them with false values from his own emotional life. Thus Circe can change human beings into beasts, causing them finally to be completely absorbed in selfishness and in false activities of one kind or another. And of course, not only do these other companions of Ulysses represent other wayfarers seeking home, they can also be interpreted as the various separate faculties and powers of his own mind and nature. So that, of course, the fact that he cannot save them, and that they must all perish along the way, indicates also that the various attributes and aspects of his own mind cannot survive truth, and that only the one, the master faculty of all, can reach the destination. All others must pass or die along the way, being a race of opinions, attitudes, convictions, of concepts, which have not their foundation in the heroic destiny. Therefore, they cannot survive. We can go considerably further with the problem of Circe, but I think it gives us some general pattern with which we are to work at the time being. Now let us also bear in mind, as we said, that Neptune, who is the guardian of the seas and to whose aquatic allotment Ulysses belongs, is himself a strange and mysterious power governing the middle diffusions of the objective universe. Neptune is peculiarly patron over the psychic life of man. Therefore, if his spirit belongs to Jupiter, his soul belongs to Neptune, and his body belongs to Pluto or Hades. Each of these has his own laws, and it is the duty of each of these gods, according to the gravitational power of his nymphs, or the spirits that pull for him in one way or another, to hold life to these levels over which these deities have dominion. Therefore, Neptune, representing the psychic field, does not wish Ulysses to escape. And in the long journey which is through this fluidic element, the psychic life, when it seems that Ulysses is about to escape, Neptune brings the great tempest to bear upon him, giving him all and terrible evils and injuries, and causing him, as the commentaries say, the gravest doubts and misgivings. Of course, this is exactly the psychic field, doubts and misgivings. Under the great stress of temptation, of trial, of hardship, of frustration, the individual becomes doubtful. His certainties are weakened. He is no longer sure of his own course. He is afraid. He does not know as yet that there is a true land or a true home which he is going to be able to attain. Thus, along the great journey of life, the individual is beset with hardships, and the storm of life threatens to close over him, and the psychic stress threatens to engulf him. And in this emergency, which is the greatest that he must bear, Minerva appears, giving him the guidance of heavenly wisdom, giving him the internal experience of security, bestowing upon him the vision or the internal participation in reality. Minerva therefore brings with her, so to say, the mystical experience, the sign, the proof, the evidence that the powers of darkness shall not prevail. And thus strengthened, Ulysses is able to escape the wrath of Neptune and to continue on his journey home. Now, of course, the great sea trip is of the journey home. It is the journey across the middle distance between matter and spirit. Now, if you remember in your concepts of ancient philosophy, and we've discussed them so many times, I think you can reconstruct the picture, that the three worlds, heaven, earth, and hell, spirit, soul, and body, were represented by the ancients as three elements, fire, water, and earth. Therefore, the physical world was earth. The psychic world was water, and the spiritual world was fire. And these were in the forms of almost concentric orbits, with the earth represented in the center, surrounded by the zone of water, and that surrounded in turn by a zone of clouds and fire. This threefold division of the world, represented by fire, the causal sphere, the source of life, by matter, the world of effects or bodies, and by water, the intermediate distance. Plato says that souls descended from the Milky Way and fell into humidity and finally into the bodily form of the earth. The earth itself floated in water, and we have the theories of Anaxagoras and Anaximenes concerning these elements, and the old doctrine of Thales, who said that the earth itself was like a ship floating in water, and earthquakes were caused by someone rocking the boat. This concept, however, was not water as we know it, but the humidic field of energy that modern science called ether, but which also represents the magnetic field of the earth, or the psychic envelope of both man and the world in which he lives. Now, the Greeks understood this as a river, or as a great zone of water. And they said, therefore, that the world of the living was divided from the world of the dead, or the world of forms from the world of spirit, by a river. And we remember, of course, the river Styx, across which the blind boatman Charon rowed the hosts of souls. We remember the river Jordan and that dear old hymn, "Just One More River to Cross." And that one more river to cross was the ocean which Ulysses was trying to cross to get home. And of course the same good old thoughts in the hymns tell us that we shall gather on the further shore, that we shall all be together after we cross the river. We recognize also the mysterious sea which surrounded the Midgarden of the ancient Nordics, and in this great ocean slept the great serpent, the Midgard snake, and storms were caused by the motions of this snake at the bed of the great sea. We also have many, many accounts. Remember the great heroes of antiquity, the seamen. Remember that all the instructors of mankind are said to have come out of the sea. Remember that man, it is believed, himself came out of water as a material creature, crawling out of the sea in some prehistoric age, and still with certain rudimentary organs remaining within his body to indicate that once he was a creature of the sea. So life crawling out of sea was formed crawling out of the psychic field which enveloped the earth. But the sea also mostly became the symbol of the interval between the land of Elos, where the Trojan War was fought, and what Homer calls our own far distant native land, which is upon the other shore, upon the far side of the great sea. We remember in the Buddhist system, of course, the ship of the doctrine, which carries souls across from this world to the other land, the better land beyond, where the blessed land doctrine means security. And we see on this ship of the doctrine all types of human beings engaged in various activities while being taken across the sea of soul into the land beyond, the pure land of the northern Buddhist teaching. One man in the ship, of course, is standing on the back deck fishing. The journey of souls is not always done consciously, but this great sea of energy, which is the mother of mysteries and the source of life, also is, strangely enough, this strange sea of psychic phenomena, which man must cross in order to reach security from the pressures and intensities of his own nature. So we must cross this great sea, the great water, and in doing this, establish freedom and discernment from the illusions of this sea. For it is this psychic sea that feeds generations, and once souls have fallen asleep in the waters of humidity, they float downward until finally, like seeds in the earth, they germinate and are born materially and are locked within the world of form. The gate of this sea was the constellation of Krator, the cup. And it was here, of course, that the cup of forgetfulness was taken from one of the constellations of the heavens. The deluge myths and all these things have to do with this psychic sea and this tremendous zone of psychic power which man must cross to escape from illusion, which is the sea, and reach reality which lies beyond. So the long journey of Ulysses has to do with the crossing of this sea. The little ship in which he sails is, of course, his own nature, his own psychic integration. The ship, which is called the ship of the doctrine, or the ship of faith, or the power of the essential will of his own nature. Now, in one of his adventures, Ulysses would have been lost had he not been able to grasp a ragged fig tree that grew alone on the edge of a cliff. And the ancient legends tell us that the fig tree was the symbol of the human will, which was called upon in emergency also, and gave the individual the strength to survive the damages and dangers of this hazardous journey that he must take. Now let us pause for a moment and consider the conditions in Ithaca toward which Ulysses was returning. And we have a very interesting and remarkable picture of his faithful wife waiting for him at the end of the journey. Here we find Penelope, who has a very difficult problem on her hands. It is believed that her husband is dead, because no word has been had of him for a great length of time. And a number of ambitious suitors of one kind or another are making bids for her hand and favor. They all profess great affection for Penelope, but actually they are all seeking only the authority and power which this little kingdom will bestow if they can marry the widowed queen. Now Penelope is apt in subterfuges herself and is nearly equal to the occasion, for she has decided that she will weave a tapestry and that she will give no answer to these suitors until the tapestry is finished. So whatever she weaves each day, she takes out again at night, so that the tapestry is never done. Now this is a very nice symbol, especially when Porphyry tells us in simple words that Penelope is wisdom. Wisdom, of course, is the mysterious thing, the mysterious person, the mysterious being to whom Ulysses is striving desperately to return. All of his adventures and all of his difficulties are due to the fact that he cannot find his way home. He is in an enchanted world, the world of his own psyche. And to rescue himself from that and finally penetrate on to his own land has taken a great and terrible time. And along that way he has had some pleasures and many misfortunes, and he even found a friendly king, Knowledge, who helped him to outfit a ship. He had all kinds of experiences, but what he is trying to do is to get back to wisdom, which is the thing that has always been most necessary. Now, wisdom represented by Penelope is not worldly wisdom as we know it, but what the Neoplatonists termed essential wisdom. It is the wisdom of theurgy itself. It is the wisdom of the great power, which the attainment of which is the perfection of the heroic state. When Ulysses can get back to Penelope, he has completed his journey. He has then fulfilled what was called his Neptunian allotment. He has completed his journey in the middle level of heroes, those who must first save themselves. And so to achieve this, he must return and find Penelope. Now Penelope, as wisdom, is having a difficult time with a number of ambitious persons who wish to marry her. Not for her own sake, but for the power she will bestow. And even back in those early times when life was far less complicated than it is now, the Greeks declared that the mysterious, selfish, hateful, unpleasant, and ambitious suitors of Penelope represented worldly knowledge. All of them trying to be married to wisdom. Or more correctly, all of the materialistic arts, sciences, philosophies, and religions. Everything that for its own good, for its own advancement, was seeking for skill, knowledge, and power. Therefore, Penelope, as wisdom, was being courted by all who claimed or desired to possess her. These among themselves argued, fought, and debated as to who was going to have her, none of them knowing she would have none of them. And in order to make the situation safe for herself, Penelope, whose weaving of the tapestry of life was to represent the full story of knowledge, or the full story of true inner knowledge, always removed at night what she had woven in the daytime, so that she never finished the search or the process of completing this work. And she said she would not marry until it was finished. In other words, she would not accept any of these suitors until her own work was done. And she made certain that the work could never be done. And so, in the search for essential knowledge, in man's experience, no matter how much he knows, something at night, something mysterious, takes out that learning and must weave it again the next day. So that no matter how much we know, we never know all. No matter how much we woo wisdom, we cannot attain its completeness, and therefore we cannot fulfill the requirements. And in order to protect wisdom's works, which are the key to its own nature, wisdom forever conceals or unravels what it has done. Thus it is that wisdom hides or protects its own works, so that selfish men can never possess either these works or wisdom itself. And of course, in those days, there were among the Greeks what were called sophists. The original sophists were very great and admirable persons, including some of the great immortals of early Grecian life, like Thales and Solon and Pitarchus and Periander. But the later sophists were professional teachers who gained no reputation except for selfishness because they commercialized learning. And they were associated with false knowledge, man learning for gain rather than for good. And the false suitors in the time of the Greek culture therefore represented all the ulterior motives of man by which men seek to be wise and for purposes of injuring each other, for taking hold of knowledge as power and using it against the common good, skill to kill rather than to create and to enliven. Thus, essential wisdom kept her house, and in a strange and wonderful way, under the protection of her own proper guiding allotment, Minerva, she was able to confound the suitors until such time as Ulysses could return. Because Ulysses, if he returns, is going to be worthy of her. He is her true husband. And here the Neoplatonists point out a very, very interesting point. Namely, that Ulysses is not returning to Mary. He is returning to the wife he had before he left on the journey. And that is one of the points which is particularly important. In other words, Ulysses is not obtaining new wisdom, but he is restoring his own inner knowledge of that wisdom which has always been his. He is returning again to his own proper abode where wisdom waits for him, as it has always waited. Now when the time comes for Ulysses to at last appear, he comes not in his own proper person, but as an ancient beggar. This is, again, of course, part of the idea. He returns as the mendicant. He returns as the one who has renounced all worldly goods. He returns as a common person, coming secretly back to his own house. And the only one who immediately knows of his coming is his son, who is able to recognize him. And in Telemachus, we have a symbol which the Greeks also greatly emphasized, namely that the son, which represents the works or the achievements of the father, recognize their own cause or their own source, but no one else does. And then he is given the bow and arrow, which has been held and stored for him since he departed, the bow and arrow which no one but himself can use. And with these shafts and arrows he slays all the suitors, destroys them. And the Greeks say that in so doing, he achieves actually the final overthrow of all the dissonant elements of his own soul, that he overcomes all the errors and illusions which are within himself, and he also penetrates and scatters all false concepts concerning wisdom. He destroys the false suitors of wisdom. But there is another interesting peculiarity of this fable, as much of which much is made. Namely, that when Ulysses returns home, and even after he has slain the suitors and regained his original appearance and estate, Penelope does not recognize him immediately. As the poem says, she hopes, she thinks, she wonders. One moment she believes, and then she does not believe. She is not sure that it is Ulysses. Now, the answer to that in the Neoplatonic doctrine is that essential wisdom, which resides within the higher psychic life of man, has been so separated from the lower personality that when man, through experience and trial, returns to wisdom, wisdom does not at first even recognize the being who went away. That it has so completely changed and altered all its nature and appearance that for a time, wisdom is not sure of her own psychic nature. She is not sure of the returning hero who represents the redeemed and regenerated powers of the personality. The personality, in other words, returns home as a stranger. it returns home as one not easily recognized. And it is only after a time that this recognition by wisdom is accorded. Now, if we study the Neoplatonic concept of wisdom, we shall also understand a little more of why this is true. Wisdom, representing the anthropos, or the higher parts of the oversoul, with their intuitive powers, this does not and did not descend into matter with the extension of its own objective psychic nature. Therefore, the psychic totality of man is not necessarily informed as to the appearance and nature of the personality dependent from it. Therefore, when the objective being returns to psychic totality, it may not immediately or evidently be known. It is not that which departed. It is a different and a completely changed being with which wisdom has no immediate association or contact, but to which wisdom is finally restored and united in a full and complete understanding. Part of this allegory also occurs in Lawrence's work of the 18th century, The Adventures of Common Sense. For wisdom plays an important personified role in that work also. Now also in the Odyssey, there is another intimation that when Ulysses returns to his own homeland, his own psychic nature, he also then seeks the shrine and mystery of his ancient father. He goes further, but there's not too much about this, but there is just an intimation that he is seeking for his father, and he goes alone to seek his father. And this aged king, the ancient king whom he seeks, is itself a very wonderful symbol. It is distinctly stated that Ulysses goes alone to visit this lonely king. Here we have the definition given by Plotinus of what constitutes the mystical journey, the journey of the alone to the alone. And in the closing parts of the Odyssey, we have this almost completely stated in the Homeric version. By this we mean that Ulysses is not only now completing the heroic cycle of Neptune, but is now about to join with the cycle of his old and venerable father, who is above, who rests in a superior state. In other words, he is then ready to progress into what is called the allotment of Jupiter. His next allotment will then be that, having redeemed or perfected his own nature, he will then pass into the highest order of heroes, those who live not to save themselves but to save others. When he returns and searches for his father, he bids in that way for the next step or the next allotment from the gods in the heroic order. It means that at that time he has perfected or completed his own life cycle. Now, there is also no doubt in the world that the story can be regarded, and perhaps was at some time regarded, as a religious or ceremonial pageant, and that it may well have been performed as part of the state mysteries of Greece during the period of the rise of the Orphic Dionysiac tradition. Under these conditions, of course, Ulysses becomes the eternal candidate seeking initiation into the mysteries. Ulysses passes through 12 distinct adventures, which correspond to the 12 labors of Hercules. And also these represent the passage of the sun through the 12 signs of the zodiac. Thus we have an astronomical mythos, which is repeated also in the Arabic fable of the story of Sindbad the Sailor. The adventures of Sindbad are undoubtedly based upon Arabic impressions of the Odyssey. The story, of course, is also rather strongly set forth in the parable of the prodigal son. It is checked and rechecked in the story of the book of Job. All of these legends recur among different peoples. In the story of the prodigal son, the son goes down to the flesh pots of Egypt and wastes his substance in riotous living, and then he returns home. And when he returns home, for him the fatted calf is offered up, because the dead is alive, the lost is found. And this return to the Father's house, which is also contained in the Gnostic hymn of the Robe of Glory, all represents the journey home on one or other level of mankind. The Ulysses story is called heroic because it is archetypal. In other words, the difference now becomes philosophical on another level. The personal story of any person's journey home, to the degree that it is personal, is human. But your scriptural writings, your great epical works, are archetypal. They are not the story of a person. They are the story of emotion involving all persons. They are the story of a state which must be attained by all human beings. Therefore, they are archetypal. They represent a path that all must follow, or many at least, must follow. They are no longer, therefore, the stories of individuals, but the stories of prototypic beings. Therefore, they are called heroic. They are heroic because the key to them is the key to the regeneration of whole orders of life. In this case, the key to the regeneration of humanity. You will observe also that in these rituals, whether it be in the story of Ulysses or any other, we do not have any embodiment of the power of evil. We have always the journey home representing the conquest of the psychic polarities of the self. All of the agencies involved, even including Minerva, Neptune, and Pluto, are all within the individual. They are all levels of being within his own consciousness, which makes the entire subject very highly psychological and teaches very distinctly that man's conquest of self is the supreme achievement in the light of nature. The Odyssey covers many things. One other which we would like to mention because of its great interest, and that is the story of the descent of Ulysses into Hades. This is part of one of his adventures. And he goes down into the underworld, and there he perceives certain terrible and sad spectacles. He perceives there the results of the psychic pressure. The underworld, as described by Ulysses, becomes therefore the proper symbol of a sphere of extreme neurotic conflict, a sphere of complexes, frustrations, and neuroses. All the beings in these underworlds are repeating blindly and continuously some symbolic action associated with the difficulties or the conditions which caused them finally to come to this sphere of darkness. Thus, this underworld represents the zone of man's subconscious or unconscious life. And Ulysses, descending into it, finds these symbolic excesses. One, the man who is rolling the boulder up the hill, and every time it reaches the top, it escapes from him and rolls down again. And he must go back up and down forever, unable to escape this strange load to which he is attached. This entire process of rolling the boulder is nothing but a very thin, veiled statement of ambition. It carries the individual's tremendous dedication to some unworthy and unnatural purpose, which, having no content in reality, can never succeed. The individual who rises merely falls, and who falls merely falls to rise again. And on in a great cycle, a cycle of pressures, the individual becomes the absolute psychic slave of his own impulses. Thus the underworld is locked within the human being as the source of habits, of these things that we do again and again and forever without real reason or without real purpose. And Ulysses is taken down into this world in order that he may see the psychic consequences of these addictions to inadequate concepts of existence. Each one of his adventures carries the same message on some level of sensory perception. Gradually, however, he clears this sensory perception. For when the time comes, he recognizes Penelope, although she does not recognize him. He knows at all times the purpose of his journey, but he is not always sure that he will survive. Here again we can have elements from the rituals of initiation, the temptations by which the soul is tried, as are set forth in the Egyptian ritual of the dead. Thus we have several possible levels for the interpretation of the Ulysses story, but I think that we are reasonably certain that the general struggle is between Ulysses and the concept of egoism within himself. And the various elements of this conflict are embodied and personified in his adventures and hardships. In the end, however, he is given to be returned to his lawful wife, Wisdom, and will be given power to rule ever after in happiness over the kingdom of nature, which is his proper allotment. We also know that this is the distant city toward which he is always seeking to go, and whose shoreline he does not even recognize when he sees it. This is the city of good intention. This is Utopia. This is the New Jerusalem, the heavenly city, the city of rest and peace. This is the mysterious nirvanic city of the East, the abode of everlasting tranquility. This is Surkavati's golden shores. And he is seeking to reach it because it is the city of peace. It is the city of tranquility and of joy. But it is a city, as a state of consciousness, which has been infected by these suitors who must be removed. The temple must be cleansed. And Ulysses, in destroying the suitors, fulfills the same symbolical act as Jesus casting the moneylenders from the porch of the temple. All these are the restoration of sanctity, the restoration of sacredness. And with Ulysses' poem, Penelope then finishes her painting, or her tapestry. And in this tapestry, she reveals all of the operations of natural law. Therefore, to the one who is enlightened and redeemed, Wisdom gives all of her secrets. But until they are enlightened and redeemed, nature conceals part of her secrets, and even destroys some of her work by night, so that men will not be able to fathom her mysteries. And those who are selfish and profane can never become possessors of the great wisdom or the greater doctrines, which are the secrets of nature's wondrous powers and workings. And so in the story, we have a rather contemporary trend. We have a trend that teaches us that each individual's personal journey of self-control is an odyssey, and that he too is seeking his homeland, and that he finds his homeland after strange adventures. They are no longer perhaps so picturesque as those described in the Odyssey, and there are not many Cyclops wandering around today. But within our own living, we pass through all these tragedies, and when we pass through them, they are as great as though they involved all the cosmos. And the giants of selfishness that we must slay are not less in stature than the giants of ancient times. It is, however, a qualitative victory, one in which the strength of self over circumstance, as Plotinus calls it, is the key to man's internal peace and security and his ultimate re-identification by theurgy with the eternal wisdom of the Father. These are the principal elements of the story, and by aid of these keys, I think you could read the entire work with a fair degree of comprehension, and that in so doing, you would then be thinking as the Neoplatonists thought, thinking with Plato and the others, that this fable is a thinly veiled account of each man's journey to that land which is his true home. And in that thinking, then, I think we probably have done about enough for this evening.